Okay, Dr. John is staying around for your phone calls. Dr. John Abramson, Overdosed America, next on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll take your questions for John Abramson and also maybe stories about things that have happened to you, family members, or friends that you've heard. Overdosed America. Hey, John, do you hear the stories about drugs being found in our drinking water?
I do.
Incredible.
I do, and it's serious stuff.
And it's everywhere.
It's everywhere, and there's so much extra medication that goes, and, you know, George, we've got to all sort of go back to basics. And when I used to say we ought to do what our grandmothers would recommend, but now I think we've got to say we got to do what our great grandmothers would recommend.
Yeah.
We've got to get back before all this sort of belief in externality, that health will come from external sources. We got to get back to taking care of ourselves.
Somewhere along the line, we lost something, John. I don't know what it is. Maybe, and again, the greed factor kicked in, but that's been around, I think, always, hasn't it?
I think it has. And one of the issues that I talk about in the book, Overdosed America, is that I think that we people, from an evolutionary point of view, we spent 99.5% of our human existence in hunter-gatherer bands of 40 to 60 people. And cultural cohesion was a critically important survival factor in those hunter-gatherer bands. And even more than what the group believed, that it shared common beliefs was really important. And I think that we as human beings are programmed to want to believe that the culture around us will lead us in the right direction. We want to be with the program. We don't want to have to be against the program. And now what's happened is that we've lost the hunter-gatherer band, we've lost the village, and now we're defined by this larger economic structure where the interests that create our cultural environment are largely economic. Their interests are different than our human interests and what we want for our families. And yet, I think we humans we're programmed, we're hardwired to want to be with that program and not against it. And now what's called for is we've all got to become critical thinkers and realize that we've got to be responsible for the decisions that we make. We can't trust them. We can't trust external sources of knowledge. We've got to decide what we're going to believe and what's consistent with our values and our family's values. And it's a position, I think, that human beings, you know, one would think that it would be comforting to be able to share all this information and be part of a global network. And yet I think what we're losing is that human-to-human contact that provided us with nourishment and brought us in the right direction.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Long Beach, California, west of the Rockies. Mike, go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen. I didn't know I'd go that fast. I was going to ask if you guys thought that if more people had access to their doctors rather than the emergency rooms, which we end up paying for anyway, if they had more access to their doctors for preventative care, then that number three point about our health care not being that good in this country, that would rise significantly.
Do you understand that, John?
I absolutely do, Mike, and I really want to thank you. That's a very important point. What Mike is saying is that there's less and less access to the primary care doctors who know who you are, who know what your life is about, and who know your medical history. There's less access to those kind of docs, and so people have to go to an emergency room where people don't know who they are and they don't know what they're about and they don't know their medical history, and the program gets very expensive as soon as you walk through that emergency room door. Mike is absolutely spot on, and a paper that I've been working on with a medical student going to explain why doctors are choosing primary care as a career less and less. And this is a really important issue. Over the past 10 years, the number of graduates from American medical schools going into family practice is down 50%, and the number of graduates of American medical schools from internal medicine going into primary care is down 80%. So what's happening is medical students are getting the message that primary care is not a good career. Now, typically when people look at that, because medical students can decide whatever career they want to pursue, when people look at that, they say, well, of course that's true. Primary care doctors make half as much as specialists do or less. And of course that's true because primary care doctors have to know so much instead of just one field. And of course it's true because primary care doctors have a broad responsibility that they don't leave when they leave their office because patients get sick after hours and somebody's got to answer the phone. And those things are all true, and they're very important in medical students' decisions. But the most important dissuading factor from medical students choosing careers in primary care is that the skills of primary care are derogated. They're insulted in medical school. The idea, I was teaching a seminar at Harvard Medical School, and I asked the students, they were third-year medical students, and I said, what do your professors say when you spend some time sitting by the bedside of a patient who's hospitalized for a condition that was a consequence of their lifestyle and that they could improve by changing their lifestyle? And the students said, their professors say they shouldn't waste time doing that. They should be practicing real medicine. Well, gee whiz, if somebody's in the hospital because they've got an exacerbation of their lung disease or pneumonia in a smoker, and they're still a smoker, it's a lot more important to help them to understand how that they need to stop smoking and how they can stop smoking than it is to get the latest laboratory value once they're no longer critically ill, of course. But that, because medicine thinks that only science counts and not the human factor, in medical school, students are taught that only the scientific interventions are real medicine and not the kind of interventions that primary care doctors do. So, Mike, you got it spot on. We in the United States treat our primary care doctors with much less respect than healthcare systems around the world. And because of that, the doctors don't want to go into primary care, and because of that, the primary care doctors aren't available to people. Now, it's very clear that when healthcare is based on primary care, it's less expensive and it's more effective. So again, Mike, you got it, that it has to do with quality of care and it has to do with cost of care.
Would you go into medicine today if you had to do it all over again, John?
I would, George. But when people ask me, I would. And the 20 years I spent on the front lines, 22 years I spent on the front lines, I wouldn't change it for anything. But when people ask me, or young people ask me, should I go into medicine? My answer is only if you have the calling. If it's something that you really have a passion for, in and of itself, not because you'll make money, not because you'll drive a fancy car, not because you'll have prestige, but if you've got the calling to want to take care of people, then you'll find it satisfying and you should do it. But if you're doing it for other reasons, don't do it. It's hard work and you won't be happy.
Okay, let's go next to Roseburg, Oregon. Al, you're up with us. Hi, Al. Good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Good. I have three things, but they're all quick.
Okay.
The first one is I'm fighting envy. That fellow that called in last hour, first time he'd ever called and got right through. I've been calling since it was coast to coast with Art Bell. And first time caller. Second thing, I was born in 1950. I was a $100 baby. Mom was in the hospital for 9 days with me. The doctor charged $50 to deliver me. The hospital charged $50 for the 9 days, which leads me to the third thing. I believe I have an option that I've never heard anybody even whisper about. No insurance for anyone by law. The price will drop to what the market will bear. Pure free enterprise.
Al, it is a great idea, and it solves more than half the problems. Because one of the reasons
exactly.
why this is a runaway situation is because people can spend other people's money.
Exactly.
And when doctors and hospitals bill, they're spending other people's money. So there is no question that individual economic incentives need to be brought in. Now, the $64,000 question is how you can combine individual economic responsibility with the social justice that says, look, everybody deserves to have health care. And how to put those two factors together, that you don't want your neighbor to go without health care. You don't want your kids to go without health care. So how we put those two things together is a $64,000 question. Now, I do some work trying to help companies to motivate their employees to be healthier. And one of the ideas that's coming out is a hybrid of exactly what you're saying, Al, that people who opt to participate in programs that will make them healthier will have a lower insurance premium, and there will be less money deducted from their paycheck. So we've got to find ways. I am in total agreement. We have got to find ways to bring back individual responsibility, but we also have to know that that healthcare is a public good, like police protection and fire protection, and at the same time, we got to make sure everybody can get it.
Insurance was hard to get in 1950, and I think that's why I was a $100 baby.
There's no question. There's no question, and there's no question that the healthcare industry, that doctors' salaries, that the budgets of hospitals, they've grown enormously fat because of the financial intermediaries that protect, that get in the way of your mom paying the doctor $50.
Exactly.
There's no question about it. How we can get back to that, what we've got to do is create incentives for people to take responsibility and then be rewarded for acting responsibly.
I used to be a marketing director for a county Blue Shield outfit, and it was in the late 70s, early 80s, and I replaced policies that people had that were $11 a month policies with $25,000 lifetime caps that was perfectly adequate for people. In the decade before then, in a decade I was selling insurance in, it was $200-$300 for a month for a policy for a family. Mm-hmm. So we went from $11 a month policies to $200-$300 in a decade.
No question. And major problem. And it's led, obviously, to a feeding frenzy of the financial people. And how to unwind that's the question. I think rewarding responsible behavior is the way to start back on that path, back towards the path from whence we came when it worked better.
John, two weeks ago, my 80-year-old mother mailed me the invoice that the doctor had given her and my dad when I was born, and that was $50 too. I mean, I looked at that, I couldn't believe it. You look at that and you go, I was $50.
Right. Well, I think insurance does just allow these costs to skyrocket, and people get shielded from the immediate consequence, and it becomes really taxation without representation, because people who have a baby, if the charge for having a baby goes up to, say, $5,000 total, the individual gets protected from the $5,000, but everybody who didn't have a baby is paying part of that $5,000.
Let's go to Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, first-time caller. Hey, Sue, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, John.
Hi.
I have a question about doctors giving and getting the right information.
Yes.
My husband has been hospitalized for 10 months. He originally went in with pneumonia, a really bad pneumonia, and he was given massive doses of steroids. When the pneumonia cleared up, they realized he had a brain abscess. It's something called Mucor. And they said it's probably from the steroids. Is this something they knew could happen to him?
If your husband was getting massive doses of steroids, Sue, it means that he was critically ill, that his vascular system was on the border of collapse from toxic shock. What happens is the bacteria that causes the pneumonia gets in the bloodstream, and it causes the blood vessels to lose their tone and become leaky, and that is often fatal. That has a very high fatality rate. It's awful. So I think the doctors were forced to give those steroids, and there are risks of other infections with steroids for sure, but I think the docs did the thing that they had to do in the short term to make sure that your husband survived, and now it sounds, you know, just that he's got this brain abscess, and I hope that it can be cured. What's the prognosis here?
It was good until about a month ago. Now he's going downhill. So, like, the cure is actually killing him.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I'm really sorry to hear that. That's awful. This would not be a case. I spent a lot of my time thinking about situations where people were treated with drugs that are very expensive and that weren't necessary and weren't really properly tested, and there were bad consequences. This is not that, Sue, and so I hope I can help you to be a little reassured. Steroids are very inexpensive. Nobody's giving steroids because the drug salesmen are making a lot of money. Most of them are generic, and they're very inexpensive, very powerful, and life-saving, as they were in your husband's case. But this is an unfortunate consequence of the – what happens is the steroids suppress the immune system so that there's not such a reaction to the bacteria, to the toxin that the bacteria is releasing. But in suppressing the immune system, what they did was they allowed that abscess to get going.
John, what do you know about hydrazine sulfate and its ability to cure or fight cancers?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm sorry.
All right. That's fair. Let's go to Boca Raton, Florida, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning. I was calling about your comment about the statistics on death rates in European countries and America. And I understand some of those statistics are measured differently in the different countries. For example, our death rate may include soldiers from the wars and a lot more driving than teenagers do here. The one I got most closely familiar with was the birth rate, for example, deaths of live births in Switzerland, where the babies had to be over 65 centimeters before they were even counted as a live birth. And in America, of course, we were measuring the death of counting even premature babies who died. So if the statistics in international measurements between, let's say, European countries and America are different and actually measured differently, then we're getting kind of distorted information when you say the U.S. death rate is worse than the death rate in, for example, Ireland.
Yep. Jeff, that's a very sophisticated question, and I really thank you for asking it. You're absolutely right that let's just look at the the neonatal mortality, the death rate amongst newborns. You're absolutely right that in the United States, smaller babies are resuscitated, or there's an attempt to resuscitate smaller babies mm-hmm. than in some of the European countries. And that does, in fact, distort the neonatal mortality rates. There's a wonderful paper that was done looking at this very question out of the Woodrow Wilson School of Policy at Princeton that looked at this. In the United States, we rank 37th in terms of neonatal mortality around the world. If you correct for the resuscitation of smaller babies, our ranking goes to 23rd. Well, 23rd isn't as bad as 37th, but when we're spending the most on healthcare, we ought to be doing better than having the 23rd best neonatal mortality rate.
John, we'll be back with final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk exorcisms. And then it'll be our Friday night into Saturday morning open lines. When we come back, though, let's wrap things up and take final calls with Dr. John Abramson on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. So let's assume they implement this health program. When do you think it'll take effect? Next year?
It'll be slow.
Yeah.
It'll take a long time to percolate through. One would hope that that abolishing the ban on pre-existing conditions could be implemented quickly, because that's so unfair for people who have a disease not to be able to get coverage. But it will be slow. And a lot of the fear, George, that the government will take over the healthcare system, that many people are happy with their healthcare right now, and there's fears being raised that their healthcare will change.
Yes.
That's not the case at all. Current healthcare relationships will not be altered by the reform that's being proposed. People can keep their doctors, they can keep their insurance, the employer-based health insurance system that we have. Maybe crazy, but it's ours, and we're going to keep it.
How close does this echo what Hillary Clinton wanted to do when she was first lady?
Great question. It is much less ambitious than the Clinton health plan. The Clinton health plan was going to rearrange health care into larger purchasing cooperatives. And that would have had, it probably would not have been disruptive to individuals, but there would have been an administrative change in the way that healthcare was purchased, the way the insurance was purchased. This plan will not do that, so that for people who work for employers who provide health insurance, there will be no change whatsoever. They'll keep their insurance. Their employer will continue to provide that insurance. There may be a change for people who work for employers who don't provide insurance. That's been a sticking point for a long time, because small employers either can opt to provide insurance or not, and it's very expensive. As a physician, I was a small employer, and I know it's very expensive to offer people insurance. And yet it's not fair for some companies to provide insurance and others not to. So putting in a surcharge for the companies that don't provide insurance is a way of leveling the playing field, so there's not such a disadvantage to employers that want to provide insurance for their employees.
So overall, you're in favor of doing this. You're concerned about the cost.
Well, it depends what the this is. The this is very complicated. So what I'm very much in favor of making a rule that people who have a pre-existing condition can buy health insurance at a community rate. I think that we need to do. I think we need to find a way to provide coverage for people who don't have it. But I am sure that about a third of the money that's spent in American medicine is wasted on care that's either needless or harmful. And I think we've got to figure out how to get that straightened out, so that we don't just, when we bring more people into the insurance system, we don't just throw good money after bad. So we've got to, and it's so hard, George, because every time you talk about cost containment, people worry about getting rationing. And I would like to leave your listeners with an idea that, is it rationing if there's a drug that costs $180 a month that is no better and maybe worse than a drug that costs $30 a month,
mm-hmm.
and these are real numbers for a diabetes drug, is it rationing to say that the $30 drug would be covered in full, but if you and your doctor decide to buy a drug that costs $150 more with no proven benefit, that the difference isn't covered, and that all Americans don't have to pay every time the drug companies convince the doctors to prescribe a drug that's that much more expensive? It's not fair for everybody to have to pay for these economically irresponsible decisions. The caller, Al, before, was raising that point, that if people had to spend their own $180 on a drug that is no better than a $30 drug, they wouldn't do it. But when they're spending other people's money, they are more willing to do it. And is it rationing if we say, hey, we'll cover the best drugs, but we won't cover drugs that are more expensive than that?
Okay.
All
right, let's go back to the calls. Vista, California we go. West of the Rockies, Frank, it's your turn. Thank you.
Yeah, great show. My cell phone's almost out of power, so let me get my question in real fast.
All right.
A large number of the uninsured are in the country illegally. Doctor, do you think the undocumented population should be fully participating in the system? And wouldn't that mean cutting back in coverage for, like, the elderly and other things to pay for them? No other national healthcare system allows illegal residents to be part of their system. If I went to Canada illegally, I wouldn't be able to get into their system. So I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, Frank, you raise an excellent point, and I think we need to make a decision about this as a nation. Do illegal immigrants deserve the same care that that insured Americans get? And this is a political decision, an ethical decision, and I agree with the direction that Frank is going in searching for an answer. Should an illegal immigrant's health care needs deprive an American citizen of necessary health care? I don't think so. But if illegal immigrants are here and they need basic care and they're going to be irreparably harmed without it? Should we provide it? I think compassion would suggest that we want to find some kind of middle ground that will not bankrupt our healthcare system so that we cannot provide necessary care to Americans. So I think Frank raises a good point, and we ought to have that debate out in public and make a decision as a nation about how we're going to deal with illegals.
Would you give them a new kidney if they needed one?
Tough question, George.
It is.
My inclination would be that for something major like that, you should go home. You know, if you got sick in France, you'd go home to America to get your health care because that's where your coverage is.
Of course, home for them now is America, even though they're illegal.
Yeah, tough question. And you know, I don't want to take a stance one way or the other, but I do want to say that I understand that if illegal immigrants are consuming services that deprive American citizens of services, we've got to figure out a way to address that.
What a horrible situation when you have to decide over and above money whether to give somebody a kidney or not to save their lives.
Yep.
Horrible situation to be in.
Yep. But we are going to have to deal with this fact that that we cannot continue on this trajectory of healthcare costs growing 2.5 times faster than our economy. It's a road to disaster. So we've all got to pay attention. Your caller, Al, I wish you were on the line again, because what he's saying is, look, we've all got to be responsible for the money, that the cost that we're generating in the healthcare system. And if we could all think like that and all ask our doctors to think like that, we would have a much better system. I went with my son to the doctor, and he had another problem, and he had back pain. And the doctor is an excellent doctor. I mean, I just love watching him work. He's a great guy, and he really cares. But the doctor said to my son, on your back pain, you know, I think it's going to get better on its own. Your foot is numb, and it's a little bit weak, but it's getting better, and it's probably going to heal without an operation. And then he said, but let's get an MRI and just see what's going on. And I just cringed, because if my son's foot is getting better and his pain is getting better and he's not going to need an operation, why would we ever want to spend $1,000 getting an MRI to see what the facts are that we're going to do nothing about? And I think we've all got to learn how to be more responsible.
Next up, we go to Lawrence, South Carolina. Paul, your question. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, sir. First of all, I was just trying to call in earlier about 11 o'clock tonight concerning the ball lightning that you was talking about going through windows. My mother and grandmother used to tell me stories about a basketball-sized ball lightning coming in and hovering in the living room and then leaving. The next thing I would like to say is concerning chloramine and fluoride. Why in the world would we even put this in our water, and how would we get it out? Tell us about that. You asked us to call in and speak about stories that we've had. Had an ex-girlfriend. Her father had a daughter that had died at a young age concerning a hospital overdose of the wrong type of medicine and the wrong dosage. She was hospitalized due to scalding in the bathtub from a babysitter and whatnot. Also, I was shot in the face a few years ago repossessing a car down here in Gray Court, South Carolina, and I suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Talking about our health care and all of this mess I hear on Coast to Coast and Obama, I can't even get Medicaid or anything of that nature for help. I was also denied over $5,000 from the Victims Advocate Group to pay for my medical bills. So I'll hang up now and let you answer my questions and whatnot. Thank you very much.
Sure thing. As far as the fluoride, of course, we've done a major program on that, and we have always endorsed getting that stuff out of our drinking water. It's a dangerous chemical. But, John, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think we got seduced by fluoride, and there are two sides to that story for sure. But Paul raises some very important questions, and let me address a couple of them. One is the hospital safety issue. There has not been enough attention to hospital safety, and some folks up here at Harvard are doing just a beautiful job with hospital safety issues. The problem with safety is that it tends to individual who makes the mistake. Virtually every mistake that's made is a failure of systems, because there need to be redundant checks probability that one person could cause a serious error gets reduced to close to zero. So we have been lax on the safety issue, Paul. You're absolutely right, and that needs to be fixed. And that's not, I wouldn't blame corporations. I wouldn't blame doctors or hospitals. I'd say we just have been, we've been naive about the cause of mistakes, that they're not, they're generally not individual mistakes. They're system failures, and they need to be looked at that. The other point that you raised, Paul, the post-traumatic stress disorder that you're suffering from, and I can hear it in your voice that there's pain, and you deserve think bottom line, when you cut through all the politics and all the rhetoric about health care reform, I think when working people need help, they should get it. That our country can afford it. There's got to be-
John, we've lost you, John. So we may have lost you. So I may have to just go to the open line calls. We'll try to get a new connection with you, but we may not be able to do that. Let's go to John in Long Beach, California on the wild card line. John, you're up with us. Hi there, John.
I'm your second call from Long Beach tonight.
I'm not...
I was going to ask you, maybe you can pass it along to him from one John to another. I wanted to ask him, he mentioned how powerful the pharmaceutical companies are and that they could ruin politicians. I want to know what steps how they would go about doing that if they were to try to ruin somebody. Nobody's bigger than, I think, than the political system, but I just want to know how that would manifest itself. And second of all, I wanted to ask him, you know, these for-profit hospitals now, used to be many hospitals were not for-profit, you know, and now we have more and more of them. Is there cleaning in the hospital and things like that? Do you think that leads to more staff infections and things at the hospital where you don't wipe out the infection and then it mutates and becomes, you know, stronger and stronger? If that has something to do with for-profit hospitals maybe cutting back on cleaning here and there?
Okay, well, that's a good question. Let me ask you something. Have you ever had a bad situation in your personal life where pharmaceuticals almost destroyed you?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I haven't, but I know, you know what, I know people that got strung out on pharmaceutical drugs. I think one thing that's misleading about drugs, they talk about the illegal drug trade. I think that would pale by comparison to the people that are hooked on legal drugs. I think it's just as serious a situation. I had a family member that got addicted pretty much to certain medications, and it was a hard time getting them off.
I think that's a huge problem
that's not addressed, and I don't think the pharmaceutical industry is real. You know, look at Brett Favre, guys like that got hooked on Vicodin, which is really only morphine. It's basically synthetic morphine. It's not, you know, and guys get hooked on it. I mean, we have examples in professional sports right there.
And somehow people are getting these drugs on the streets now, and they're selling them for like uppers. Johannesburg, California, we go. Idonna, you're on Coast to Coast. The doc's not with us, but you've got me.
Hey, George, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You're a joy at night. I'm up here with no TV, and all I have is a good old radio.
That's all you need.
Anyway, I wanted to tell you, I, too, my dad was in the Korean War. He came back home in 57. He got Charpino. He would go to a hospital right down in Torrance and get his shot of morphine, and they would cut him loose. And he got killed coming out of the hospital by the Torrance Police Department.
No.
They had a malfunctioning siren. Okay. My grandmother was put into Camarillo for alcoholism, and she flipped out because they were giving her LSD. This is true, George.
Well, hey, we know what the CIA did with LSD, so who knows, you know?
Okay. And it's my whole family has been wiped out from some sort of error or neglect. My brother had leukemia. He recently passed away. We couldn't, he was on Social Security, but we couldn't afford the interferon treatments. It was just, they were $85 a pill.
See, and do you think then, and this is where health care is important, that somebody should have been able to step in, government, and took care of him and say, here, this is what you need. This is the care you need. We're going to help you.
Well, they do, George, but then but they don't. You go to the doctor, well, and to the pharmacy, and it's a whole different story there.
Well, that's when you got to bring out your wallet.
Yep, and, you know, if you don't have much in that wallet, you know, can't get turnips. So
if you don't have insurance, your pharmaceuticals are outrageous. Let's go next to Eugene, Oregon. Mike, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Mike.
Hey, George. Great to talk with you again.
Sure. We've got about a minute for you.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, I just had a question about the antidepressants that they're giving out nowadays. I think everything can be solved if everybody just eats in an organic, you know, non-GMO balanced diet.
Well, I think a lot of these antidepressants contribute to even more depression and suicides and everything. They just had a survey released yesterday that says they have increased dramatically over the past few years.
Yeah, but my biggest question, which I wanted to ask Dr. Abramson, is, you know, half the articles for even the best journals, you know, around half, are submitted by the pharmaceutical or the drug companies. it's my opinion that all of these antidepressants, you know, what they do is they limit the uptake of serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine, which are, I believe, the precursors to serotonin. And that's not the issue, because the issue, I believe in most cases, is people have enough of these chemicals in their brain, but they have trouble digesting them, or their brain chemistry.
Absolutely. A lot of it has to do with the food they eat. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.